I greet you in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ at this service of celebration in honor and in memory of Martin Luther King Jr., a servant of the Lord. May we stand and join in the singing of the hymn of freedom, Lift Every Voice and Sing. It's number 32 in Songs of Zion. Let us join in prayer. Lord of mercy and justice, you entered this world powerless as a baby and died helpless on the cross. Help us experience the sufferings of those who are powerless and oppressed, so that our indifference or abuse will not increase their suffering. We ask this in your name, Lord Christ.
The Old Testament reading is from Isaiah, the 52nd chapter. Awake, awake, put on your strength, O Zion. Put on your beautiful garment, O Jerusalem, the holy city. For there shall no more come unto you the uncircumcised and the unclean. Shake yourselves from the dust. Arise, O captive Jerusalem. Loose the bonds from your neck, O captive daughter of Zion. For thus says Yahweh, you were sold for nothing, and you shall be redeemed without money. For thus says Yahweh, my people went down at first into Egypt to sojourn there, and the Assyrians oppressed them for nothing. Now therefore, what have I here, says Yahweh, seeing that my people are taken away for nothing? Their rulers will, says Yahweh, and continue all the day my name is despised. Therefore, my people shall know my name. Therefore, in that day, they shall know that it is I who speak. Here am I. How beautiful upon the mountain are the feet of those who bring good tidings, who publishes peace, who bring good tidings of good, who publishes salvation, who says to Zion, your God reigns. Hark, you watchmen, lift up your voice. Together they will sing for joy. For eye to eye they shall see the return of Yahweh to Zion. Break forth together into singing, you waste places of Jerusalem. For Yahweh has comforted his people, and he has redeemed Jerusalem. The Lord has bared his holy arm before the eyes of all the nations. And all the ends of the earth shall see the salvation of our God. Depart, depart, go out thence, touch not unclean things. Go not out from the midst of her purity, Purify yourselves, you who bear the vessels of Yahweh. For you shall not go out in haste, and you shall not go in flight. For Yahweh will go before you, and the God of Israel will be your rear guard and shall be very high. And many were astonished at him. His appearance was so marred beyond human semblance, and his form beyond that of the sons of men. So shall he startle many nations. Kings shall shut their mouths because of him. For that which has not been told them, they shall see. And that which they have not heard, they shall understand. God bless the reading of his holy word.
The New Testament lesson is from the Gospel of Luke, the 4th chapter, starting with the 14th verse. And Jesus returned in the power of the Spirit into Galilee, and a report concerning him went out through all the surrounding country, and he taught in their synagogues, being glorified by all. And he came to Nazareth, where he had been brought up, and he went to the synagogue, as was his custom, on the Sabbath day. And he stood up to read, and there was given to him the book of the prophet Isaiah. He opened the book and found the place where it was written, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord. And he closed the book and gave it back to the attendant. He sat down. The eyes of all in the synagogue were fixed on him. And he began to say to them, "Today this scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing." Thanks be to God for this word.
It is with great pleasure that we welcome all of you to this service of worship, this 15th annual Martin Luther King service of worship. Many of you have come from local churches and church agencies and the community, local churches, pastors, and others, and we are delighted that you joined with us at Wesley Seminary in this celebration. We welcome especially to this pulpit the Reverend Dr. Joseph Eccles Lowry, the president of Southern Christian Leadership Conference and the pastor of Central United Methodist Church in Atlanta, Georgia. I feel very personally glad that Joe is here. We go back a long ways. I said to President Lewis as we met in his office earlier this morning, "I've known him all of his life," and then I corrected myself. "I've known him all of my life." He is really my father in the ministry, been my mentor. Born in Huntsville, Alabama, was the director of youth and really encouraged me to seek some concerns about the ministry at a very early age. He served as the executive secretary of education for the Central Alabama Conference of the United Methodist Church. It was the Methodist Church in those days. Was an outstanding pastor in churches in Alabama, Mobile, Birmingham, later St. Paul, was always concerned about the issues of social justice and evangelism together, always. And his ministry has reflected that. He's been called on to preach across this country and across the world. Annual conferences, pastor schools, colleges, chapels, universities, international conferences, as a preacher of the gospel of Jesus Christ. It's out of that his own sense of calling and his own sense of ministry that he and Fred Shuttlesworth and Martin King got together, the three of them, to organize the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. The three of them. He was to serve as the first chairman of the board of directors of Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Their first meeting, well, they got together to organize in Atlanta, and then the first meeting in New Orleans. And he was quickly elected as the chairman of the board of directors of SCLC and served as the chairman of the board of directors of SCLC until the time came after Martin's death that somebody had to become the president of SCLC to follow in the footsteps of Martin and Ralph Abernathy. It was with reluctance, and I know it was with reluctance, that Joe Lowery agreed to serve as the president of SCLC, but everybody was clear. He was the natural leader, the natural person to become the president of SCLC. Part of his reluctance was, he reminded us over and over again, but I'm a pastor. He has refused to give up being a pastor. And so he serves. Even though he's all over the world and all over the country, he always tries to get back to Central Church to be there on Sunday morning to preach to his people. It is that kind of preacher that we welcome to our pulpit today to preach in this chapel now.
I'm indeed pleased to share in this service with you and to be with an old friend whom I've known all his life. Remember in the early days in Alabama when we were organizing a conference youth meeting, the first one we had on an annual conference level, and Bobby and Bill Dobbins, another friend of ours who was pastoring at Clark Church in Nashville, who passed away last year. But they were working with me. I was executive secretary, and I think Dobbins was director of youth work. Bobby was associate, and we had our first conference youth assembly, and my father died a day or so before the youth assembly, and I couldn't make it. And Bobby and Bill Dobbins sent me the meanest telegram I've ever seen, chastising me for not coming to the youth assembly and letting the dead bury the dead. Such was the, you know, that's the way young seminarians think. So when you get all off base and confused and seek counsel from Dr. McLean, he can counsel you out of the theology of experience. And that was in the Bishop Bowen was our bishop then, and he called us all together and gave us a great lesson, because I was going to fire all of them from the staff. But I've watched his career. I do not take any credit for calling him into the ministry. Too early yet to do that. I don't know how he's going to come out. Good to be here with your distinguished president and on this campus. I thank you for the opportunity. I know you're not responsible for the weather, but I can't say that I came up here into the cold weather, because in Atlanta it was 8 below. And sorry you had to miss the parade. I thought that was one of the saner decisions of this administration. let's hope that portends some improvement in the sanity for the next 4 years. However, I did not come to deliver partisan. I'm not a Democrat. I spoke to the Southern Democrats, Black Southern Democrats, met in Atlanta last Saturday, and I told him I did not come as a Democrat, I came as a Methodist, and I'm not sure where that puts me on the political spectrum. I was thinking on the plane about your celebration of the birth and life of Martin Luther King, Jr. congratulate you for that. Just so long as our celebration of his birthday is not a substitution for the celebration of his life. The celebration of a birthday is often purely ceremonial and not necessarily sacramental. Observance of a life, celebration of a life, should be sacramental. Ceremonies end with the benediction. Sacraments begin with the benediction. So the life of Martin Luther King Jr. must challenge us to more than ceremony, more than ritual, but to life itself. And as we come this morning, I was thinking about that verse, and I don't have to tell you where it is in the seminary. You know where it is. If not, go look it up. It's up in, it's that one about you shall beat your swords into plowshares and your spears into pruning hooks and study war no more. I like that one. And I want to speak from the subject. I spoke out in San Diego University last spring, I think it was, at a peace meeting, and they kept bothering me for my topic. And they started 6 months ahead of time asking me for my topic. And I wrote them back that was what was wrong with the peace movement. They didn't rely on the Spirit. Anybody know the Spirit doesn't give you a subject 6 months ahead of time. Finally, they kept pushing me for it, and I gave one. I told them I was going to preach on beating plowshares into swords. And when I got there, the program was printed, beating swords into plowshares. The fellow said he figured I made a mistake, that the text was, the Bible said, beating swords into plowshares, so he put that on. But I really wanted to talk about beating plowshares into swords. And I got that notion when I was in the university at Catania in southern Italy, in Sicily, really, lecturing on nonviolence and public policy. And the mayor of Comiso, a little village 20 or so kilometers from Catania, heard I was to be present and drove up and invited me down to Comiso. And so I drove down there with him, following one of the lectures, and he had been mayor of that city for 25 years. He was no longer mayor. He was heading the peace movement in Comiso, and he carried me down to Renaissance Square in the heart of the city, where they had, under his mayorship, put a little memorial to Martin Luther King, and he wanted me to see that. And after we stood there and had prayer, we went out on the hillside and looked down across what was once a fertile valley of fruit trees and vegetables, a valley rich in soil and enriched by the labor and love of generations of people who had lived and nurtured themselves off the land. And there we watched where bulldozers had turned the soil upside down and buried the trees and buried the fruits and destroyed the roots of fruits and vegetables, and concrete had been poured over to prepare for a missile base to be placed there by us. And I thought about it. Not only are we not beating swords into plowshares, but we're beating plowshares into swords. In August of 1983, we pulled together a coalition of conscience that had 400 to 500,000 people in our nation's capital around the issues of jobs, freedom, and peace. We had considerable discussion about that theme, that call of jobs, peace, and freedom. First of all, we had some reticence on the part of some of our allies who wanted to put the march around jobs and freedom but leave out peace. We had some members of the coalition who felt that they ought not to get in the peace issue, but keep it on jobs. The media had interesting comments. They said, first of all, we couldn't get anybody to come to Washington. That Martin Luther King had 250,000. We wouldn't have anybody hardly at all. Well, we had almost double that many. And then the media said, including your own distinguished Washington papers, that the focus was not clear. They said that, yeah, they had a crowd, but they really clouded the issue when they put peace in it. Too unclear what they're talking about. Interesting comment, because from our perspective, not only was the focus clear, but we think what they were saying was the focus had become too clear. That we had come in those years that had passed between 63 and 83 to realize the inextricability of the issues of jobs, freedom, and peace. We had come to understand that the issue of justice was a holistic issue. It had to be approached from the holistic perspective. And in the black experience, that's not hard, because we've always, from theological or sociological perspective, approached problems from the holistic perspective. We've never fragmented and broken up and departmentalized and compartmentalized society nor our theology. We always looked at it from a holistic perspective. And we look at it's not in the black, it's not in our experience to divide folks up. The black church is the most interesting theological and sociological phenomenon in the world. You have one pew of PhDs, the next pew no D's, the next P Mohaus, the next D Nohaus, Mohaus. It didn't make any difference. We were all children of God, and we all had to approach our problems from the same human perspective under the love of God. And so we've come to understand that we cannot deal with jobs and justice without dealing with peace. We've come to understand that, and that's why black folk need to be more involved in our foreign policy. We started out early, took the scriptures and made a spiritual out of it. Study war no more, down by the riverside. Gonna lay down my sword and shield and study war no more. We've never believed in beating plowshares into swords, but swords into plowshares. We need today, in the memory and celebration of Martin Luther King, to approach our problem from that holistic and universal perspective. When our forefathers sang down by the riverside, the river was always a very important factor in the black experience. The river was important. It was provided food. We used to catch catfish and clean them and eat them all in the same breath. River was important. The river not only provided food, it was fellowship and fun for swimming and playing and wading. Then it was an instrument of faith. It was there we baptized, confessed our sins. And not only that, it was an instrument of freedom, because if we could get across the river, we could make it on toward the promised land of liberty. So the river was important. And when we sang down by the riverside, we were talking about the wholeness of life committed to the issue of peace. And I'd just like to take 5 minutes this morning, six. as the spirit moved. to talk about beating plowshares into swords from the perspective of King's ministry. Martin looked in 1967 at Riverside Church, at the issue of justice, and cried out against the injustice of the Vietnam War and how it wove its way into the civil rights struggle. And when he raised that issue, he was severely rebuked by his compatriots. History has a way of repeating itself. When I went to the Middle East in 1979, after Andy resigned from the United Nations, I went over to meet with, first we met here with Terzi and Yehuda Bloom, the Israeli ambassador, and then we were invited by Arafat to to come and talk about the peace initiative in Lebanon. We went, met with the president of Lebanon. When I came back, I met the same rebuke that Martin had met a few years earlier from the same people. They had different names, but they held the same office because didn't quite understand the relationship between jobs, peace, and freedom. And we don't understand it too much today, but we've got to understand it. And the church, the community of faith, must lead that struggle. We must not leave the struggle for peace simply to those outside of the community of faith who are interested in peace. Peace is our hallmark. Peace is our byword. Peace is our theology. Peace is our faith. Peace is our word. And we must tie it to the holistic struggle for the kingdom of God. Martin said and challenged us to engage in the struggle against racism, poverty, and militarism. Today, the authentic patriot, the authentic member of the community of faith, is the same thing. The true authentic patriot is not one who puts these bumper stickers on his bumper about love it or leave it. The true patriot loves it so much it ain't gonna leave it alone until it lives up to its commitments to let justice roll down like waters and be the land of the free as well as the home of the brave. The true patriot may cause the nation pain sometime. You always heard, who was that, the Ain brother? You always hurt the one you love. My mama loved me and hurt me real good. She used to tell me that, son, this hurts me as much as it hurts you. I never was quite able to run that through the computer, but I think I know, I understand what she was talking about. We must not be afraid in the community of faith as peacemakers. We must not be afraid to kick up a cloud of dust. There can be no settling down until the dust has been raised. And the truth of the matter is we've allowed the dust to settle inequitably. And it must be stirred up within the context of the faith in order that the settling may be a just settlement. We must be the new true patriots that cause the nation some pain. My doctor loves me. But I hate to hear him say, Joe, roll up your sleeve, or worse than that, roll up your pants, take down your pants. That, because he's about to injure me. But it is that temporary pain that initiates the process of permanent healing. If we must heal today, we must create the kind of tension that can lead to the process of healing. Poverty is so often the result of materialistic exploitation and militarism. We cannot separate these triple threats. That's a good term because all of us are thinking about football, materialism, racism, and militarism. Triple threats. They can kick, pass, and run. They pass over the poor, run up the deficit, and kick compassion out the door. Poverty is often the result of materialistic exploitation and militarism. And militarism is often the hammer which drives the nail for racism into the body politic. So that we must approach these problems from the moral perspective. The whole issue of peace and justice must be addressed from the moral perspective. And unless we in the community of faith provide the leadership, they will continue to beat plowshares into swords. Unless we help the nation clearly understand the moral nature of our problems, they will falter amidst political debate and opportunistic charades. The whole question is one of morality. If a man discriminates against me, and this is at the basis of what Martin lived and died for. If a man discriminates against me because I'm ignorant, that's my fault. I ought to know what's going down. Y'all say going down up here, going down in I make that statement in some audiences, I have to explain what it means. It means what used to mean going on, but my church is right in the heart of the university center, and we deal with what's going down. And I have to, well, you know, I have to rub up against them young cats. They'll stampede you if you don't stand up against them, you know. And so when I meet them, I say, "What's going down, man?" And right there, I'm in already, you see. But if a man discriminates against me because I'm ignorant, it's my fault. Jimmy Carter was president. He promised to increase jobs. We met with him a few months after his presidency, and black unemployment kept going up, and he kept saying he had to fight inflation. And so I was very disappointed, and I said, "Mr., we got to demonstrate our indignation, Mr. President." So when he came to Atlanta, a few months later, Coretta gave him a peace prize inside the church. We had 2,000 people outside the church giving him a piece of our mind. We were very disappointed in his administration up to that point. And a college professor came to me a few days after and said to me, said, "I'm disappointed." I said, "What's the matter?" He said, "You shouldn't be demonstrating against Mr. Carter." I said, "Mr. Carter is our friend. He just got back from Nigeria." He said, "When did we had a president go to a black nation? He loves us." I said, "Listen, Professor Fool." He didn't hear me say that. I just said that. If you don't understand, Mr. Carter did not go to Nigeria because he loves colored folks. He went to Nigeria because Nigeria is the second largest source of crude oil for this country. And if we don't understand the relationships, you know, if we don't understand the inextricability, if we don't understand what's happening, that ignorance would be our downfall. If a man discriminates against me because I'm ignorant, it's my fault. I don't know what's going down. If a man discriminates against me because I'm loud and uncouth, that's my fault. I ought to know when to whisper. I ought to know when to shout. If a man discriminates against me because I'm dirty, that's my fault. If I can't afford nylon and oilon, my nolon can be clean. But if a man discriminates against me because I'm black, he raises a moral and theological issue over which I have no control and don't want any control. So the question of justice and jobs and peace are basically theological and moral questions, and we abdicate our responsibility when we allow them to be adjudicated in some other arena or forum without. That's why most writers would keep referring to Martin as a civil rights leader. They don't like to call him a prophet. And whenever I can, I correct them about me. I'm not a civil rights leader. I's a preacher. And hopefully in the prophetic stream, but they want to relegate it to civil rights because they can put that in a corner and usher it on into some irrelevant state. But the moral and theological issues are less accommodating to shifting into arenas of irrelevance. In the 60s, yes, it was Martin Luther King and SCLC who raised the prophetic voices against militarism in Southeast Asia. Bombs exploding in Vietnam in the 60s, he said, would explode in our economy in the 80s. Black citizens not only have a right, but we have a responsibility to be active in shaping foreign policy. We were among the first victims of the corrupt foreign policy. Blacks and browns and the poor are the principal victims of racism and militarism and colonialism today. In conflicts, the poor are disproportionately wounded and killed. The relationship between military budgets and budgets for jobs and job training and housing and education and health care is too clear. They're beating plowshares into swords. Third world nations are the chief victims of militarism and racism and materialism, because nations, the superpowers, will not address the needs of the third world as long as they beat plowshares into swords. We have just recently discovered the famine in Africa. It's been there for some time. But we've been so busy turning our face toward the arsenals We both so busy stuffing already overfilled arsenals that we can't think about filling empty stomachs, beating plowshares into swords. You and I are challenged today, and as you sit here in the nation's capital beneath the State Department is the most segregated federal agency, and it needs to be inclusive more than anybody else. Anyway, well, let me just tell you this. I'm through it. Got another couple of minutes or two. When I was in the Middle East, I met with Arafat. We sat for 3 hours in his office. I was trying to persuade him to try nonviolence. So let's organize a march. Let's go from Nabatea down past the Beaufort Castle toward the Israeli border, singing, "We're bound for the promised land. No weapons but the whole armor of God." You can't win freedom for your people with violence, Brother Arafat. We got him to agree to a 90-day truce, and then tried to meet with Mr. Begin, but he wouldn't meet. But later on, I learned something interesting. Andy told me that Arafat told a good friend of his, the United Nations, said, "If anybody other than Joseph Lowry had come into my quarters and tell me to stop fighting for my people, I would have taken my pistol and I would have blown his brains out on the spot." Now, that didn't make me feel too good, because old Yasser been known to do that. Now, what he meant was, it was not Joseph Lowry, the individual. It was what I represented in terms of the black experience. That's why he listened, because he knew that we had been where the Palestinians are, way down yonder in the valley, where we couldn't hear nobody pray. He knew that we'd come up the rough side of the mountain, and he sympathized and empathized with that experience, and he's willing to hear. That's why we need more black folks in the State Department. We carry universality of countenance. We carry a holistic approach to salvation and jobs and justice and peace, the same thing. And that's why they need our sensitivity there. And that's why the community of faith must raise that issue over and over again. We understand from the missional perspective that we cannot divide mankind into secular or spiritual, that we are brothers and sisters, whether we're in Cairo or Chicago, Athens, Alabama, or Athens, Greece, Tulsa or Tel Aviv, Mobile or Managua, Jackson or Johannesburg, San Diego or Santiago, El Salvador or El Ghetto. We're all the children of Almighty God, brothers and sisters, inextricably bound together. There is no path to fulfillment for any of us that does not intersect the path of the rest of us. Martin put it succinctly in the question of race: there's no path to fulfillment for black that doesn't intersect white, and no path to fulfillment for whites that don't intersect black. Yes, whether it's the women's movement, we must build a new kind of coalition of conscience, and I want to talk about that tonight, but just briefly today to say that the women's movement is significant because it too is a challenge to the community of faith. And you know, if not because we have the same goal, because we have the same enemies. Same folks who oppose women's rights oppose voting rights. Same folks who opposed the peace movement, opposed the women's movement, the voting rights movement, the black movement, the youth movement, same enemies. This came really to my attention. I went to fast with the ladies who were fasting for ERA at Lincoln's tomb when we were having the voting rights pilgrimage up through 5 states in 82. I left the pilgrimage to fast with them, and somebody asked me, said, "Why did you go fast with them? They didn't come march with you for voting rights." I said, "Well, they may not know who they is, but I know who I is." And I know it's the same struggle, and they understand that, many of them too, and we're coming to form coalitions that shall be powerful. But it came to me on a flight from Washington to Atlanta. I was sat on a plane, and got ready to take a nice flight, and I heard a female voice coming over the intercom. And it said, "Welcome aboard Delta flight so-and-so. We're going to fly at an altitude of 38,000 feet at a ground speed of 560 miles an hour. Should be landing at Hartsfield International Airport in Atlanta in about an hour and 32 minutes. I said, "Great." And I got to thinking, I said, "Wasn't that a female voice?" I said, "Oh, that's all right. Must have been a stewardess." Now, it occurred to me, stewardesses do not discuss altitude and ground speed. Occurred to me that we had us a woman pilot, which was fine with me. I'm liberated, you know. Didn't make any difference to me. I did put sugar in my Coke and straw in my hot tea, but that was all right. But I went around, looked around. I didn't see any more brothers and sisters on the plane to share this bit of information with. Four or five white brothers across the way. And I said, "Hey, fellas." Yeah. I said, "We have a woman pilot." And they said, "The hell we do." And I said, "By heaven, we do." And then the stewardess came down and they stopped her. They said, "Hey," and she knew, she anticipated their question. She said, "Yes, we do." She's one of two beautiful Delta female pilots. And then they said, "Oh God, fasten your seatbelt, boys." And every time we hit a little bump, they would cry out, you know. And I was laughing as you are until I realized I shouldn't be laughing. Because they weren't laughing with her. They were deriding her. And as a member of an old minority, I should not be in a position of joining derision upon any right now minority in terms of pilot. But I decided it was an opportunity to teach him a lesson. And so I joined the faculty of American University Wesley Seminary for just a moment, and I said to them, "Hey, fellas," yeah. I said, "You know, I saw her when I got on. Not only is she female, she's black." If you see three or four white fellows floating around, now she really wasn't black, but I was speaking from an ontological perspective. There is an interrelationship between our struggle. The beating of plowshares into swords is not an isolated issue. And you can't separate the issue of full employment, of voting rights, of world peace. They're tied together. And we must help the nation see them holistically. And we must bring to bear the moral imperatives of the faith on these great issues of our day and of our time. We must stop the nation from beating plowshares into swords. Our foreign policy is bellicose and interventionist. And we are headed, I'm afraid, in these next 4 years, I can see less and less reluctance building up on the part of this administration to use military force to impose our will upon lesser nations. Yes, I was in Nicaragua last December, and I say this, and I visited a little village on the Atlantic coast side of Nicaragua called Bluefields. It's a black city. I didn't know we had that many black folks in Nicaragua, but the whole city. And I asked us, "How did all y'all get down here in Nicaragua?" You know, and I forgot my history. All the ships didn't make it. We took over some of the ships and guided them to other shores and started colonies down. That's where the whole city, it's a poor city. Sewage missing, hospitals missing. Samosa, even though they speak English on the Atlantic coast side, Samosa made them teach school in Spanish. And so the black kids dropped out of school after the first day. And so the illiteracy rate is tragically high in Bluefield. And we visited there, and we preached in Bluefield. We visited with the people, and one beautiful black young woman who worked in a bank said she had watched on television, she had seen some of the brothers invading Grenada. And she said, Reverend, when you go back home, tell the brother. She said, I have an 11-year-old boy, and every weekend, she said, I go out and practice with the militia. They tell me that the Sandinistas are violating human rights in Nicaragua. I'm sure they are. They're only 5 years old. We are 200 years old. We're still violating human rights. So I don't know that we expect them to achieve in 5 years what we haven't achieved in much longer period. In fact, we held folks in slavery for a pretty long time. And we need to judge others by our own standards might help. But she said, tell the brothers. And one other thing, you know, they say they're violating human rights, and I'm sure they are, but they are arming the people. And I just can't conceive of a government giving people arms whose human rights they trample on. If I'm mistreating you, I ain't about to give you a Browning automatic shotgun. I don't give you even a flip if I'm mistreating you. But this is what she told me to bring a message. She said, they invaded Grenada with little resistance. Tell the brothers, don't come across our border because I've got sights on my gun. And if, as much as it would pain me, if I see a brother coming across the border, invading our land, he's a dead brother. He said, I know they're going to kill us. They're going to wipe us out. Your military might is so much greater. But I gladly die for my liberty. I thought about an American who said that earlier. Give me liberty or give me death. We must, in the community of faith, challenge the nations. Bellicose and militaristic foreign policies now will not work. We are reacting poorly to the decolonization of Central America. That's what's happening. We've got to learn that the bananas and the cocoa and all the things that come down now that they want to share a little more equitably. They don't mind the United States working as a partner, but the day of Yasser Foss is, you know, that's gone. And we have to understand that. Why should we engage in such policies that drive people to seek allies thousands and thousands of miles away when we are here next door? Our love, our respect for their human dignity should attract them with such magnetism that they would not need to turn to alien shores or to alien ideologies to seek out their place in the sun. Beating plowshares into swords is a way of crushing human dignity and denying the human spirit its hunger for self-determination. We've used the right words. We've used the words of the masses, but we turn our faces to the classes. We recite the words of liberty, but we march to the drumbeats of colonization. We intone the prose of justice, but we dance to the music of oppression. We lift our voices in equity, but our melody is exploitation. We have the lyrics of peace, but we respond to the sour notes of militarism. Our rhetoric is democratic, but we pay the pipers of despotism. We're beating plowshares into swords. And the community of faith must call forth the nations to stop beating plowshares into swords, to beat their swords into plowshares, to come on down by the riverside, to put on a long white robe. I used to wonder why they wear robes. You know, I wouldn't tell you soon, but really, mankind got to put on a robe because the robe hides our distinctions. You don't know whether I got on a blue suit or pinstripe suit or brown suit. It's no better than a worse than the suit you've got on. The robe cloaks our differences and highlights our oneness and our similarities. We're all the same beneath the robes of humanness, and that's what we need to go down by the riverside to study war no more. We're one in creation, one in the redemptive love of Jesus Christ, one in the fellowship of the church. We must call upon the nation to cry out of the community of faith. Beat our swords into plowshares and to study war no more. Don't have to worry about how it's going to come out. We know how it's going to come out. We don't know how long it's going to take or what price we're going to pay, but we know how it's going to come out. Been decided long time ago. The world doesn't know that, but we know that. Why are we keeping it a secret? Preach it to the world. I came home from church one Sunday. Arthur Ashe was playing in the Wimbledon. He was playing Jimmy Connors for the Wimbledon. Now you think I was pulling for Arthur Ashe because he was black. That's only half true. I was also pulling for him because he was older than Jimmy Connors. And he was closer to my age group. And I knew if Arthur didn't win the Wimbledon that time, he probably would never win it. Now, Jimmy would still be around, and Jimmy is around. Arthur's now the coach or somebody consulting. Jimmy's still playing. And I came home, and Lisa Young, Andy's daughter, and Cheryl, my daughter, they inseparably were sitting around there watching television. And I told my wife to bring my plate in the den because I had to watch. And she said, "What's that sermon you say about family?" I said, "Not now, baby. We'll talk about that later. Bring the dinner on in here. I got to watch. I got to get Arthur through this tournament." And the kids were sitting there eating popcorn and talking, and I was watching. Arthur wasn't doing too well. And I was telling them to be quiet, and they said, "Daddy, didn't you preach about don't be anxious?" I said, "Shut up. Don't confuse me with facts. This young generation has no respect for, you've got no racial pride." I kept watching, and Arthur looked like he was losing, and I couldn't digest my food, and finally the children were sure I would have a heart attack, and they said, "Daddy, take it easy." I said, "Shut up." They said, "Take it easy." I said, "I can't take it easy. I got to pull Arthur through." They say, "It's going to be all right." And I said, "How you know it's going to be all right?" They said, "Daddy, the game was played 3 hours ago. This is a replay. Arthur Ashe won." It's already been played. The battle is over. The victory won. They played it one day on Calvary. On Calvary, they played it out. Victory is ours. We just must claim it. We know how it's going to come out. Why I walk so timidly through the marshes and through the wilderness. Walk boldly. You've got history and the future on your side. Stop the nations from beating plowshares into sword. Call them down to the riverside where they'll study war no more.